football on off the ball.
Toby, I'm just a little bit standoffish, to be honest, and I just said that to the lads in the dressing room. We're getting too much respect. And for me, on a football pitch, when you give teams too much respect, it's a fear. Yeah, didn't like it.
Join in the obsession. Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.
How do we usually start this?
I feel like I need the sting in my head.
Oh no,
I think they'll go all the way to the final, to be honest.
Yeah?
Yeah. I believe in my county, and I suppose they're good at football, they just have to believe in themselves.
I love playing 12, I love playing 10, I love being on the pitch, to be honest.
Are you confident?
Absolutely not.
No!
Thank you for all the supporters. Thank you for the team, thank you France. Merci la France, merci les baguettes, merci les croissants. Je vous aime, I love you.
Hello everyone, welcome along to Word on the Street. We're in a slightly different setting this week.
A bit exotic.
A little bit exotic, that's Ticknock in the back. We think. Yeah.
Our geography skills aren't great, but we know that we are in Carrick Mines.
Yes, we're in Carrick Mines Lawn Tennis Club. Croquet and Tennis Club, I believe.
I think there's croquet going on in the background, actually.
Yeah, there is. Love it's it. An absolutely stunning location. But why we're here for the 2025 Irish Tennis Open, which has been an incredible event.
It's been amazing. It's a futures event as well as being on the ITF tour. So there's ranking points up for grabs. So there's a lot of young and upcoming Irish tennis players playing today.
Yeah, and we don't have an episode name for this. Not our usual intro, but we'll think of a clever one and we'll come back to you. But so it's interesting. We were learning a little bit about kind of the different levels that there are in tennis. I think anyone who might have read Conor Nyland's book has a little bit of an intro to this, but I've read it and I was still kind of blown away.
Yeah, I mean, because when you are at an event like this, which is a futures event, you know, there is players who, I think the highest player ranked here is something like 600 in the world. So it's players who aren't entering into the kind of main ATP draws of the, you know, Masters 1000 tournaments or even the Grand Slams at all, really. I think there's one player here who played at a Grand Slam. So these are players who are really using these tournaments to build up and try and get to that kind of top 300. And you can see that in so much of Colin Ireland and what he wrote about, how much of a struggle it is to reach kind of the upper echelons, I suppose, of the tennis world, because it's such a solitary sport.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's basically, it goes these events, the ITF future events,
yeah.
Then you're up onto the ATP Challenger Tour.
Yes.
And that's where you have your 250s, your 500s, your 1000s. So that's basically on your ranking.
Yes. Yeah, so it goes ITF here, which is men's and women's. Then you have the ATP Challenger. Then you have the ATP Tour. This is for the men's.
Yeah.
And that's where you have your 250s, 500s, 1000s, and then your Grand Slams. The women's now, they're go to the WTA tour and they have their various tournaments and then play the Grand Slams.
It's so interesting that it splits into men and women after this level.
Yes, the International Tennis Federation, which runs the Irish Open here and runs most tennis tournaments around the world, that encapsulates both men and women, and the WTA and ATP will work within that. And then you have it separately, and there's different prize money in the women's and men's draws. And the Grand Slams, I think we have Billie Jean King to thank for equal prize money there.
But and a fantastic movie.
Yes, indeed. And so there's differences there. But what you have here, and if you ever come to the Irish Open, you can see, you know, there's men's singles happening around the place, and then on the court beside it, you have women's singles, and there's doubles as well.
It's quite a nice thing at these events, like, that you can see a mixture of everything. Yeah. Obviously, it's not your Wimbledon, but like, it is quite cool to walk around and have, you know, such a high level of tennis still.
Oh,
doubles on one court,
yeah.
A men's singles going on, a women's singles on the other court. Like, there's just so much to see.
Like, we were saying to each other earlier on that the level that these players are playing at is so high. Like, they're excellent, and yet they're ranked maybe 699th in the world.
Yeah.
And that the difference between them and, you know, Iga Swiatek or Arina Sabalenka is so small compared to the difference between them and like someone who plays us who play tennis for leisure only.
No, 100%. And it is mad that I think when you look at, say, an Irish tennis player and they're ranked 650th in the world, maybe you take a glance and you're like, oh, meh, not great. But actually, if you got 650 people in a room together, tip-top athletes, really there isn't all that much.
There's not many players in the world that are better than you, and that's all across the world.
Yeah, and with the amount of people who play tennis,
it's
actually some feat.
Especially considering, you know, so many other countries have more resources for their tennis players. Like, there is only one, I think this is the only kind of Irish Open that happens And I think every player that we talked to today has said, I'd love if there was more events in Ireland that I could play at home, you know, for so many reasons.
Yeah, we were actually chatting to Amar earlier, who I think he's a singles player and he's fourth ranked in Ireland at the moment.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm not sure his world ranking, but we can find that out later. But he was kind of talking about that, about how great it is to have events in Ireland and then also why it would be so great to have so many more. And so events like this then, is that how they, like, what's so great about having one in Ireland? That mainly, that you don't have the cost associated with going abroad, but that also you have your family and friends around.
Yeah, definitely. And I can be here, like, my dad is my coach. So here, I'm here with my dad. I can train at home in my local club and then come and train here. It would be great if they had more of these on, because then throughout the year, let's say it could be like, if they had five or six, that's five or six tournaments a year where I don't have to go abroad, spend money on flights and accommodation. So yeah, hopefully going forward, they can put more tournaments on here.
Insane. And then if they had those five or six more, or five or six total, would that help you then in the rankings? Because if you do well in a couple of them, then maybe you can get up to the challenger, is it?
Yeah, definitely. Like for this week, for example, I got a wild card, which meant I didn't have to play two or three rounds of qualifying to get through. And I won my first match. A lot of the times when I'm abroad, like Tunisia, for example, I have to win three matches just before I get into the tournament. So I'm playing three matches, no prize money, no points. And a lot of them, they're tough. You know, good players, like especially the last round of qualifying, you're playing against a guy who's won two matches, he's also fighting for points. And then after you get into the main draw, sometimes you're just tired, you're wrecked, and you lose just because you're not fully in it physically. But it helps, definitely having home advantage, getting a wild card, it's a big help.
Yeah, it is mad. Like, he was also talking about how, you know, here you can get wild cards and how much more difficult it is. I think we touched on this on our pod when we spoke about Wimbledon, but how difficult it is compared to maybe the bigger tennis nations.
Yeah, I mean, you could really see that, and that's why, you know, he even said that some countries would swap wild cards.
Yeah, I'd never heard of that before.
So we were talking to him about, he got a wild card for this tournament, and it reminded me of Emma Raducanu and her US Open run in 2021. Like, she was a wild card to come into that. And I thought it was kind of off the back of her great Wimbledon performance. And I think Amara revealed that there's a little bit more, that often, and this maybe wasn't the case for Emma specifically, but in general, what happens is that, say if you're an Australian tennis player and you want a wild card to the US Open, they could give you one in exchange for a US player getting a wild card for the Australian Open when that rolls around in January. So a little bit of politics that go on behind the scenes.
Yeah, it is interesting.
Which is so devastating that Ireland's not really ever going to be a part of that.
Yeah.
Because we don't have a Grand Slam, but B, I don't think our tennis culture and the resources we provide to our young tennis players is as advanced as it could or should be.
And it's unfortunate because the UK is like a stone's throw away.
Yeah.
And so many of our players will travel there for a lot of their tournaments, especially when they're younger.
Yes.
But yet, you know, as he was saying, the top players in the UK, obviously it's a bigger population, more players, but still, top players in the UK can get wildcards to Wimbledon. Wimbledon, yeah. Like the biggest tennis event.
Yeah.
Whereas here, the best they can get is this, which obviously it's class for them, but it is just a gulf in like opportunity.
Exactly. And like even for trying to get sponsorships and everything, it's difficult. And I think as well, the amount of Irish players, and this isn't limited to Irish players alone, English players go through this as well, having to go to college in America or having to live then or move to kind of mainland Europe and to play tennis there. It makes it very difficult when you don't have a base, maybe, or you have to move when you're so young, because the amount of, I mean, kids that we see here, and their form is fantastic. Like, you are from such a young age devoting your life to tennis.
Yeah, absolutely. We were actually chatting to another player/coach here called Sinead, who she was on the tour, but she's since come off, but she's here today just kind of not playing socially, but...
Well, she's a member of the tennis club, so...
Yeah, she's a member.
Whatever.
Yeah, that's true. But anyway, she spoke about how you have to start tennis so young and how you devote your entire life to it. Sorry, so you start so young.
Yeah.
It's really like you kind of give your whole life to tennis in that way.
I think with tennis you have to, because there's so many aspects of tennis with technique and physical, and if you don't have good technique or learn technique from 7, 8, 9... I mean, you don't really have the foundation then, so it's a sport that you do have to start when you're very young and have exposure to competitions and everything.
Mad. That explains my awful forehand.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's also mad, like, as Sinead was saying, you devote your whole life to tennis, but then once you come out of college and you decide to go on the tour, you have to give up so much again. You might have, you know, Amar was saying earlier, you might have no sponsor, no coach. It's a financial burden and you're just out there kind of doing it all by yourself.
Yeah, because Amar, he had just left college recently enough. He'd gone to U Dublin. And it's like a wild west out there. I think eventually now his father is his coach, which, you know, two birds with one stone, you're travelling with your family and
handy.
Your coach. That's handy. But yeah, he really did detail, I think, the struggles that come with not having the resources of the top class players and trying to come from a normal background and make it in this sport, which I think Sinead said as well, that can cost up to €1,000 a week.
So at the moment, like for me, for example, I don't have a sponsor. So if I'm going to tournaments, I can't afford to take a coach with me. If I'm at the tournaments, I don't really stay in the official hotel. I might go to a place just off site to save a bit of money. So you're at a slight disadvantage compared to someone who has a whole team around them. Let's say he's supported by the French Federation. So you gotta have this like belief that you're going to make it even if you're not sure of it. You know, you got to kind of convince yourself that I'm going to keep going with this and then kind of trust the process.
God.
Yeah.
What's mad is that along all those struggles, Amar's decided to document it.
Oh, yeah, I love this.
I love it too.
We were introduced to him not as, this is Amar, and he is the fourth best tennis singles player in Ireland right now. This is Amar, he started a YouTube channel.
It's obviously what he wants to be putting out there, to be fair.
Yeah, and it kind of just details his life on the professional tour. He was in Tunisia recently, in Germany, and he's obviously here now. And I love that it provides a really honest insight. It's sort of like the digital version of Connor and Islands.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. It's like, if you're too lazy to read, well, now you have a way to watch this. Yeah. And it is, I think, important, because I read Connor and Islands' book, being an avid tennis fan, but having no idea about the depths that it goes to and the struggles that these athletes have to put up with. So I do think it's such an important thing to be doing.
Yeah, and I think just showing the daily realities, because I think if you watch tennis on the TV, it can seem a very glamorous lifestyle. But also if you're a kid growing up and you're playing tennis, it can seem so far away. And so to have somebody who, you know, you've probably seen playing here last year, he was here last year, and you see quite frequently, like so many of these people, you can see there's such a community feel, they all know each other because it's such a small tennis community here. To see him, you know, traveling the world and documenting it, it's great for young players as well.
Yeah. Let's listen to Amar talk about why he decided to set up the YouTube channel, because it is a bit unique, let's say.
Yeah. You have a very interesting, I think, take on being a player on the tour. You set up your own YouTube channel. What's it like being on the tour and documenting it?
It can be a bit tough because every day when I'm playing, like in a tournament, I'll have a match and I'm training. And then at the end of the day, if I'm trying to make a YouTube video, I'll just be tired. Maybe I'll just not want to do it, or I'll be starting with it and then after 30 minutes I'll just fall asleep. But I'm trying my best, trying to make as many YouTube videos as I can, sharing my journey as a professional player.
Do you think it's important to show kind of the behind the scenes life of a player on tour at the level that you're at? Like, we don't really see much of that.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially a player from Ireland, because there's not really that many of us and there's not that much support for us. So a lot of us are kind of doing it on our own. We're trying to travel here and there, kind of making ends meet if we can. It's interesting because a lot of the other people who are interested in sports, they're watching team sports. And with the team sports, you have a whole team, you're traveling together. But tennis is quite unique in the way that you're so on your own. There's not really a team behind you.
Yeah, because it's so interesting because a lot of people have read Conan Ireland's book and a lot of people know him as kind of the face of tennis in Ireland. But there's so much going on kind of behind the scenes.
Yeah.
Is your YouTube a little bit of like documenting that struggle of there's so much going on, nobody knows about it, but we're grinding out every day trying to get up to the top?
Yeah, exactly. I would like to do more vlogs and share more journey if I had more time to do more vlogs. But it's definitely like that, trying to show what it's like to struggle from the beginning, because everyone goes through it at some point. At the beginning, you just gotta find a way to break through, because once you get to the top, you're making enough money to have a team around you. But at the moment, just kind of on your own and trying to scrape by.
The side to kind of starting a YouTube channel and documenting the personal side of tennis and the personal struggle is something that we've been talking about across all the sports that we cover, and how important it is to put yourself out there on social media these days and how that is what garners attention. And I wonder, kind of at the lower levels of tennis, is that going to be something that's important moving forward because they don't have eyeballs on them yet?
Yeah, in a way I think it's unfortunate that you need to be on social media nowadays to get eyes on you maybe to get sponsorships, but I think that's just the reality of the world that we're living in. And, you know, it's a simple and relatively inexpensive way of getting your name out there.
Yeah.
I mean, to even look at the higher levels, like Aryna Sabalenka, and what, like, she does so many TikToks with her team and everything.
And Coco Gauff.
Coco Gauff does a lot as well. They're great for marketing purposes. You know, I mean, Carlos Alcaraz is, I don't think he's on TikTok or he doesn't post as much.
Never seen it.
But he is so marketable as like a Gen Z tennis player. And
oh, sorry, yeah, everybody else posts him.
Yeah, well, basically.
And the speculated romance between him and Emma Raducanu. I live for it.
It's just so, everything is marketing for, everything is money in sport when you're trying to get to the elite levels, really. You know, maybe in football you can kind of get through academies if you have enough talent and if you're born in the right place, but for tennis they're so costly. And so I think anything that you can do to get eyeballs on you, to get some sponsorship, to put your name out there,
it's fair play to them.
Yeah, because it's scary starting a vlog series.
No, 100%. And as he said, it's time consuming as well, because you know, he's just finished a long day of travel. He's on his own. He's exhausted. Yeah. And now he has to go edit a YouTube vlog.
Like, for Carlos Alcaraz, everyone else is doing the work for him.
Oh, 100%.
Editing all these videos of him. Amara's doing it on his own.
Yeah.
Fair play.
It reminded me of, there's a TikToker called Anna Fry in the States. I don't know if you've come across her. And she's a tennis player. She's just finished school. She's about to go to college. But she blew up super randomly off somebody else's TikTok. And she has millions of followers. And now the opportunities that she gets. And I think she's a very good tennis player. She's going to a very good college. But she, you know, she's not on the tour. She's not massively ranked yet.
Yeah.
But everybody knows her name. And sponsorship, no problem.
Yeah.
All her outfits, all her rackets. I saw recently she put up a TikTok of all the stuff she's gotten going to college. You know, laptops.
Yeah.
Anything and everything she needs is just available.
Yeah, and I think especially for players who don't come from a background of wealth, or maybe from a tennis family, like Stefanos Tsitsipas's younger brother is here today playing. I don't think he would need to market himself in that way. He probably has a lot of connections from that. But if you don't have, if you're kind of on your own looking for connections, I do think social media is going to be the way to go in the future.
Yeah, it is a bizarre concept.
Whether you love it or you hate it, I think it's here to stay.
Yeah.
This marketing yourself via social media.
In every sport as well. We've seen it across the board. And people always talk about that in how in women's sports, we see it a lot more than men's sports. And there was a lot of talk around the Six Nations, the women's Six Nations, that, you know, why are England rugby doing this? It's so unprofessional. You don't see the men doing this. And it's like, well, the men don't have to.
The men get all their marketing done for them from the big stations and
also they're big enough already. They have the audience. The problem is when you're, whether it be in a women's sport or in a lower level sport like this, if you need support and you need eyeballs and you need marketing, it is just where you have to be.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's such an interesting concept. Anyway, we've gone a bit off topic, but hopefully interesting to other people as well. But I do just want to talk a little bit about some of the kind of prospects from an Irish perspective.
Yes.
I think Sinead talked about Leah.
She did, Leah Tuck, who is 14 years old.
Yeah.
And she's a name that's cropped up a lot kind of over the day or the few hours that we've been here.
100%. Yeah, let's listen to Sinead chat about her first before we kind of delve in. Having an event in Ireland, we were chatting to one of the players earlier and he just said it's so nice because he can sleep in his own bed, he can have his coach here. Like, it's incredible. How important is it to have kind of more events like this here?
Yeah, I mean, it would be amazing to have more events here over the year. Having one is nice, as you said, but again, it's not giving Irish players much of an opportunity to get points. And it's also just expensive to be travelling the whole time. So it would be amazing to get even 3 or 4 futures events on in Ireland over the space of the year.
And can I ask you actually quickly, you said you were coaching a little bit.
Yeah.
Leah is here. She's 14.
Yes.
Is she somebody we should be looking out for coming up through the ranks?
Yeah, definitely. I play a lot with Leah here for the last year or two, and yeah, she's a great player. She's only 14, she did so well quali this week, and she has a lot of potential, so I think if she can keep developing, she can do really well.
And any other big names in Irish tennis at the moment?
There's a few good juniors coming up. Scarlett Foley is very good as well. Jane Doyle, she's under 12.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, there's a few boys. Patrick Breen, he's also from Waterford. He's been doing very well. And Zach Naughton, Owen Jennings.
So, as she said, Leah is 14. She's already competing kind of as one of the best Irish female players here today. As you said, there's been so much buzz around her. When I asked about coming to the tournament, the first thing I was kind of told about was that, you know, she won, I think, both her games in qualifying. I don't know how she's gotten on today. We'll have to find out. But she had won everything up until today.
Yeah.
So what an exciting prospect for Irish tennis to have.
Exactly. I mean, because you look at some of the players that you see every now and then at Wimbledon pop up, and it's these, like, young players who get given wild cards and everything. Obviously, we don't have that. What we have are tournaments like this where players can make names for themselves. And you can see there's so many development people wandering around and coaches, and they all know each other.
Yeah.
And a lot of them are mentioning Leah's name.
Yeah, another exciting prospect is actually standing right there, but is Michael Agui, and he is the highest-ranked Irish tennis player at the moment.
He's number one in Ireland.
Yeah, so he's 637th in the world, but he has reached a career high of 401, I think.
Yeah, at least in the 400s, yeah.
Yeah, which, as we said earlier, like, that is incredible.
So impressive. Because when you look at kind of Agui and what he's done in the past year, like in 2024, he won four tournaments. He's coming into this now on really great form. And he's used to playing in big pressure games. He's played in the Davis Cup. He actually played against Dominic Thiem. Which
mental.
So exciting.
Yeah.
It's fantastic. And to represent your country while doing that is amazing. So he is probably one of the... I'm not going to say our best chance at breaking into these higher ranks, because that's a lot of pressure to put on him. But he's definitely the name that's cropped up as the player of the present. We have players of the future, and then there's players who are right now performing at a very high level.
Yeah.
I think that's Michael Agui.
But it is interesting that, you know, Conan Island is kind of the face of Irish tennis. It's what you think of when you think of Irish tennis. And he reached maybe, what, the 150s, I think?
Yeah, it's still, from a kind of a outsider point of view, it still looks very low.
It does, but it's not. But I think also for Ireland, what maybe put him on the map a little bit as well was playing at Wimbledon.
Definitely. You know,
like, speaking about eyeballs, that is one of the biggest tennis events, probably the biggest one if you're an Irish person.
Definitely.
And he always talks about how, you know, suddenly the media were interested and suddenly they were there and suddenly people wanted to talk to him. It's like, it is difficult. You're kind of grudging along at these events and you're going to all of them, and sometimes on your own, and nobody cares really how you're doing.
Yeah, it's when you see players who kind of maybe burst on the scene at Wimbledon and it's like, wow, where did they come from? Well, they've been here at these events trugging, like, for years, working their arses off really to get where they are.
Unless they're like 16-year-old freaks.
Yeah, like, oh my God, some of the, like, I remember seeing when Coco Gauff first played at Wimbledon, she was like 14, 15 years old, and you kind of knew then, okay, she's going to win Grand Slams.
Yeah.
Like, this is a child, and she's going to win Grand Slams.
It is, yeah. It is, like, it's difficult to comprehend the gap that is there between the elite and these levels, but then also difficult to comprehend, how small that gap really is.
I think the gap is more in resources and money and eyeballs, and obviously talent along with that. But I feel like if you gave one player here, you know, all the money in the world to have the sports psychologist that you need and the physical trainers that you need and the, you know, you can have all your transport to everywhere you need to go, they'd pull up the rankings fairly quickly.
Yeah.
You know, so it's, there's all these factors combining at once that make a tennis career.
It's so difficult as well, because these ITF events, you only gain a handful of points, I think, if you win it.
A handful of points and not much money.
Yeah, actually, Sinead spoke about this earlier, so we'll let her talk about it because she obviously knows much better than us.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, Nyland's book was very honest. I think he gave a very honest report of what it's like. Again, like, when you're starting off, you're playing futures events, 15,000s like this. This is one of the best ones that I've ever seen. Usually, you know, you're not given transport and it's not as nice of a setup, but I mean, it's very lonely when you're on your own. You know, if you're, yeah, it's expensive to obviously bring a coach with you and you're not making money. I mean, if you win a 15,000 event like this, you're only getting probably €1,200 because 15,000 spread out over the whole tournament. So yeah, it's expensive, it's lonely, and then you're putting everything into it, and if you're not doing well, it's very demoralising.
Yeah, I can imagine. So alongside, you know, the expense it costs to run this tournament and then the little kind of prize money that comes out of it, there's also so many people, I'm sure, they have to pay in terms of kind of staff at these events.
what's incredible about being here and kind of soaking in the atmosphere here is just how many people are doing different roles around the place. And sort of, I think what you take for granted when you watch tennis on the TV, like we got the chance to chat to an umpire who's here from Germany and kind of about his experience being here in Ireland and then working as well abroad as an umpire.
And talk to us, you're a chair umpire. That's you travel a lot for these kind of events?
Yeah, so most of the times we do work in our home country, so Germany for me. And sometimes we do get the chance to work abroad, such as here. That's some exchange programs we have. So basically both countries benefit from it. Here they can have some officials coming over and we can get some experience abroad. So kind of a win-win and very nice for us to be here.
And is it a bit of a hobby or is this a full-time career?
Yeah, well, it does differ depending on the certification, for instance, and also the time commitment that you can have. For me, I also study apart from that, and this is not my main job. But there are also some full-time officials. Also, some of the other colleagues here are working full-time. So, yeah, for me, it's a nice job apart from my studies, and I work as much as I can, yeah. Work on the lines as well, on some bigger events. So, yeah.
Just what events have you done?
Well, I would say my highlights have been on the line, the Masters in Madrid and the Lever Cup last year in Berlin. That was really great. And on the chair, I've done a couple of Challenger tournaments and World Tennis Tour. So these have been the tournaments I've done. Yeah, and now here in Dublin as well for the combined event.
And of course, being an umpire, a line official, we had to ask him about the recent switch to AI in Wimbledon.
Yeah, and I was expecting him maybe not to answer because it could have been a I don't know, a conflict of interest or something, but no, he gave his two cents.
It was weird though, he wasn't too angry about it.
No, he's German, very level-headed.
Okay, let's hear what he has to say anyway. And how do you feel about the live technology as a umpire?
Well, I mean, obviously the accuracy is very high, so I think that's the factor that counts, and then there are arguments in favor and against, but that's just the way it has been decided now.
But a lot of officials must have lost jobs in when that happened, when they decided to take all the kind of line officials out of it. How do you feel like from that perspective, from the kind of human side of things?
Well, I think most officials have been working chair and line, especially those who have worked the slams. So now they would maybe focus more on chair umpiring. And also even with the live electronic line calling, we have the match assistants who then assist the umpires, for example, escorting players to toilet breaks, managing the ball change and being a reserve if the technology were to have an outage. So there are still opportunities to work even under these new conditions.
What do you feel about the AI? It was interesting that he was talking about how not that many people might have lost their jobs because they have different opportunities. I'm not sure. I feel like the articles that came out when it made the switch were all about people losing their jobs, but maybe that was just a bit of a...
I feel like if you really, really want to keep your job, maybe you'll find opportunities. But the thing is, it's opportunities are going to be harder to get by, to come by. That's the thing. It's you're making an industry far more precarious.
Yeah, the pool is smaller.
The pool is smaller.
And supply and demand.
Yeah, exactly.
My small amount of college economics.
I just feel like it's making people's lives harder if you're in that industry. And of course, you know, the accuracy is improving. And you can see that in every sport, technology is being incorporated more and more. But it is never good when you're seeing people, and people did lose their jobs over this, or maybe lost opportunities, perhaps.
Yeah, we did do a whole pod about kind of technology and sport, and what the public think about new AI and across various sports and stuff like that. So if you are interested, search up. I can't remember what we called it. Word on the street.
Was it our ref?
No. Ah, ref, that's it, you're correct. Word of the street, ref.
We've done too many episodes.
Yeah, we have. But if you are interested, you can find it on the Off the Ball, kind of Spotify, Apple, wherever you get your podcasts. Mm-hmm. But we do just want to mention before we wrap up some very interesting people we chatted to today.
Yes, now this was so unexpected, but I think maybe my favourite part of the day.
Yeah.
So we were walking through the kind of toward the Players' Lounge, I think that's what it's called, and we came across two racket stringers.
Yeah.
Roger and Michael.
I think those were their names. Roger, after Roger Federer, maybe.
Maybe.
Should have asked him that, really.
And if you had said to me beforehand, what's the science of stringing a racket, I probably wouldn't, you go upwards and you go across.
Yeah.
But we spent probably an hour talking to these two lads about their career, because it is a career. This is their livelihood and their job. And the science behind it and the technology behind it and as well the emotion behind it. Yeah. Like, they love their job.
Yeah, they really do. And they know so much about it.
Oh, my God, they're so intelligent.
And it's incredible. Like, I think it was Roger. He has worked at various events, including the likes of Wimbledon, and strung for people like Rafa Nadal, Federer. So it was incredible learning from him about what it's like not only to come up, like to come close to these kind of legends, but also how the relationship is built between a stringer and the player and the details they need in their strings and how specific it is to not only the type of player you are, but also who you're playing, what part of the game you're in.
What the weather's like.
Yeah, they were talking about, you know, in Ireland, you string your rackets differently and with different material because it's wet. There's just so much behind it.
Yeah, it was one of the most interesting conversations I think I've had in a long time, to see people who are so passionate and knowledgeable about their trade, which is very niche.
Yeah.
And to see how, with such professionalism, it's conducted at such a small level tournament compared to somewhere like Wimbledon.
Yeah.
Like, it's still done with incredible care.
Yeah.
And, you know, all of these tennis players that are playing here right now, they are trusting them with their rackets, which is their livelihood right now. And it's, I think it's really beautiful.
Their livelihood, that's so true, actually.
Yeah, I think it didn't get caught on camera, but I remember I asked Roger, I said, I've had the same tennis jacket for 12 years, so should I need a new one, my strings? And he kind of looked, he's like, yeah.
In shock.
Shock.
In pain, probably.
In pain from my 12-year-old tennis racket.
Yeah, absolutely. But that that chat, we just felt deserved its own platform.
Yes.
It's really an incredible 30 minutes if you have the time.
Incredible 30 minutes of your life. It's just an insight into a part of tennis you don't really see.
Absolutely. So we're going to publish that on the Off the Ball kind of YouTube pages, maybe as a podcast as well. We'll see how that works out, but keep an eye out for that.
Yeah, that'll be coming soon.
Yeah. Other than that, any final thoughts from the Irish Open 2025?
I just think it's such a great atmosphere that's run so smoothly. It's great to get the chance. I mean, as we were walking in, we saw Michael Agnew warming up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just great to see the people who are at the present and the future of Irish tennis all kind of gathered here.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I hope there's more events like this Ireland in the future.
I do think the Davis Cup is coming up in, I want to say, September. And that's back in Ireland again for the first time in a while. So that'll be another chance for kind of people to see Irish tennis players at the top level.
Exactly. And put a few more eyeballs.
Yeah, which is all it really needs. Well, not all it needs, but part of it.
A little bit of luck, lots of talent, and a few eyeballs doesn't hurt.
I like that as a final word. So this has been Word on the Street. A little bit different this week. Not so many kind of thoughts from the public, but if you do have any thoughts, feel free to reach out to us. You can always kind of slide into our DMs on Off the Ball or reach out on WhatsApp 0879 180 180, and we always want to hear from you.
Yeah, it's all we love.
Yeah, and I'll be away next week. I'm heading off to trek around Mont Blanc.
Jesus.
Yeah, nice. RIP. Me and my boyfriend, 9 days of trekking. If we come back still together.
Yeah, exactly. Fingers crossed.
Yeah.
And we're without Rachel here. We didn't break up with her.
I forgot to mention Rachel.
But Rachel is off having some well-earned rest after some All-Ireland coverage and gallivanting around we're always gallivanting in this podcast.
We are, she's gallivanting, we gallivant too much.
Tipperary and everywhere, so she's taking some time off, but she will be back. Me and Rachel will be back next week.
Yes, and I'll be gone for a while, but then we will all come back eventually.
We will all be here together.
We promise. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank
this
you.
Has been Word on the Street, and we will chat to you next week.
I think they'll go all the way to the final, to be honest.
Yeah.
I believe in my county, and I suppose they're good at football, they just have to believe in themselves.
I love playing 12, I love playing 10, I love being on the pitch, to be honest.
Are you confident?
Absolutely not.
No!
Thank you for all the supporters, thank you for the team, thank you France. Merci la France, merci les baguettes, merci les croissants. Je vous aime, I love you.